Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to a belated Eerie House Radio, a special Sunday edition. I'm Dale Kay. I used to have a show named, I still do sort of, have a show named Spook Show. And barely, just barely, I'm here with...
And I'm just barely here, Dave, yeah. From the Weirdness Really Bad Movie. And I'm here along with...
Yes. Providing anatomically correct door squeaking since 1964, it is I, Guard the Ghoul, blah, blah.
But we won't have a blah show for you today. No siree Bob. Jim Bobberooney. We got some more on coffins, or more on coffins, or something. It's CBS
Nobody
Radio Mystery
okay.
Theater. With their episode called A Coffin for the Devil. That'll be coming up a little later on. And all kinds of fun. So stick around and enjoy the show.
Now, this has got to be fun because Gar doesn't usually get to be here for the Mystery Theaters because it's our 90-minute show so much better. And so, Gar,
yeah.
Welcome to the 90-minute program and a CBS Radio Mystery Theater.
Well, thank you. I'd like to thank the Academy. No, I guess that's somebody else. Yeah, thanks, guys. Glad I could be here.
Yeah, and for you listeners that are listening in the archive later on, there won't be an after party today for a plethora of reasons. And a plethora, by the way, is, I think, more than two.
Less than seven.
Yes, something like that. And I guess before we get started, Gar was asking us just before we got started how Goulardi Fest was. I think we should spend a few minutes on that. Dave and I attended a annual event here called Goulardi Fest in celebration of probably one of the greatest television horror hosts ever, Ernie Goulardi Anderson. Now, it's morphed kind of into the Big Chuck and Little John show since then, but it's still, you know, they always, always, always will tip their hat to the greatest of all, Goulardi.
Yes, they, because really that's where Chuck got his beginnings. He was working his way up through the ranks, basically starting off as a cameraman. Straight out of some kind of broadcast school, and worked his way up to kind of at this point, sort of writing and directing Goulardi and Ernie Anderson, because nobody else, he wouldn't listen to anyone else, and they're not letting him listen to Chuck. Matter of fact, not that Goulardi listened to anyone. If you told him to do or not to do something, you're in trouble.
Yeah. It would be certainly done. That's just how Goulardi was. To give you an idea, he once there. In fact, someone once published an actual memo from Channel 8, which was then a CBS affiliate, to Mr. Anderson and to the rest of the staff. There will be no more motorcycle riding through the studio and the back offices.
Yeah, kind of leaving it open-ended, but you know what? I don't think he did it after that, but he did one weekend at night ride the motorcycle through the studio because that's the kind of free spirit that he was. And, you know, the thing is, he really was. He liked to call himself sometimes the King of Cleveland, and he was simply because he had so many people that watched him. I mean, he always beat the Tonight Show and in the ratings. As a matter of fact, on nights that he was on the air, crime was always down. So Big Chuck has it. So even the bad guys were watching Goulardi.
Yeah. Anytime he made personal appearances, they would just pack the place. Often Channel 8 would have these sponsored softball games, and of course there was a Goulardi team, basketball as well, I believe. And these events were just jam-packed. To give you an idea, a friend of mine, a local broadcaster, former disc jockey and musician, Uncle Vic, we've been friends for years now. We met up in the nightclubs many years after the event I'm about to describe. But as a youth, Uncle Vic's a little older than Dave and I. He's in his 60s. He was a very young band member, and he was getting ready to play a school dance at a Catholic church. He arrives at this big school dance, and there's no one there. So he approaches the priest, and he says, "What is going on? There's supposed to be a school dance. It's tonight, isn't it?" And he goes, "Well, it was supposed to be, but Goulardi's on."
And you're right about the events, Dale. He could turn something that might have drawn in, at best, you know, 200 people into a crowd that would, could be easily 2,000 people or more, way beyond capacity of the arena he was supposed to be at.
Yeah. And as Dave mentioned, getting a little bit back to Houlihan, when Goulardi left 3 years later, following, you know, Tim Conway out to Hollywood, Channel 8 needed to fill that void. Goulardi was so popular, horror hosting was becoming very popular in the 1960s, and they decided to use a local weatherman on their channel named Bob Wells, who went under the name Houlihan, Bob Houlihan Wells. And Houlihan chose Big Chuck as his partner, sidekick, if you will. Chuck was petrified, having never been on camera before. But the town fell in love with him, and for over 40 years, Big Chuck hosted that show, even when Houlihan left. And his replacement was Little John Rinaldi. 40 years, that's the kind of loyalty you get out here in Cleveland when you capture people's hearts. And he's been entertaining throughout the whole time. He never got old. He aged, but he never got old.
Yeah, here's the thing. He is still on. Matter of fact, it's Sunday night here at, I think it is, what, 11:30?
Yes.
He will, after the Rizzo show, he and John will be on, and they host their skits that they've done over the years. And he's done, Big Chuck wrote and produced over 2,000 skits.
And so, Big Chuck was a local Emmy Award winner on a number of occasions.
Multiple Emmy Award winner, yes. And got a chance to direct a couple of made-for-TV movies, as well as directing local Emmys and other programs beside what he did. Chuck was a cameraman and a director. I mean, he also directed the news for many years. On top of being a talent himself, writing, producing, and putting together the movie show.
And so this event is an homage to them. They have a few staged acts, lots of vendors, which Dave was at this particular show. Dave, in his gracious goodness, always allows me to share a little space on his table so I can hopefully raise funds to keep this thing we're doing here running. People from all over, the folks from Creepy Classics out in Pennsylvania come out and sell their wares, mostly movies, T-shirts, things in the horror genre. And it's such a wonderful crowd that comes in. It's a mature crowd. There's never any problems. You don't have any, dare I say it, a-holes. There, I said it. It's just a nice, wonderful gathering of folks that are there to have fun.
And the difference between a Goulardi Fest and any kind of thing is I'd only been to Goulardi Fest. I'd never been to any kind of Comic-Con or anything like that. I was truly shocked when I went to these other places, because these other places, you pay a pretty darn good penny to get inside, and then to go meet somebody and get an autograph or a picture with them, it's going to cost you out the wazoo, far more than it cost you to get in. And yet here are guys who are broadcast legends, at least in Northeast Ohio, and truly are legends, period. Houlihan, Big Chuck, Little John, these guys are legends. And yet, you know, if you have something you want them to sign, you take it up for them, they sign it for nothing. If you don't have anything, they all have little pictures in front of them, they sell you for $2, and then they'll sign it. You know, Chuck has his DVDs there. He has, at this point, I think about 30 different DVD collections of his skits. He would sign those. He's got his book there. He would sign that. But you don't have to buy anything. You don't have to pay them for an autograph. They'll autograph anything that you have and that you want. I mean, that's why when I went down to the my first Horror Hound, I was in shock that, you know, you had to pay for all these things and all these people to sign.
Yeah.
And even more for selfie than that. These guys, they got their old gorilla sign, Big Chuck and Little John, and you go stand in front of that. They'll go. They say, "Come on, let's go. Can we have a picture?" They say, "Yeah," and they all get up and go over to the sign, and you stand right there, and whoever's available will take your picture from right in your own phone and hand it right back to you, not run out the door.
Yeah,
and,
it's a huge prop for their television show. It's a big. It's nearly a diorama of King Kong, which was a big part of their opening of their show.
Right.
I have a question for both of you guys. Okay, one, does WJW TV 8 still exist in Cleveland?
It does, but it's now a Fox affiliate. It's no longer CBS.
Okay. Next was Gullardi, the program aired from 63 to 66. Were you guys old enough to watch it?
Yes and
Dave
no.
Dave was not in the area at the time. Am I correct, Dave?
Right. Okay.
I was in Buffalo at that time.
Okay.
And yes, he was on the air, but luckily he did some other shows than just his late night show.
Yeah. Now, I do have vague memories. It was a time just after I was adopted, so it had to be about 64, 65. And I remember having the live-in, you know what, scared out of me by... the walking tree monster, Tabanga, from the movie From Hell It Came. Gullardi also had the Laurel and Hardy and Gullardi show where he would host in the afternoon for the kids. Mm-hmm. And the thing about him, Gar, and listeners, the thing about him is I truly believe that he was, if not the first, one of the first people who was really... I don't know how to put this, but he was the first person to not be afraid to take a poke at authority figures or people of great respect. There's a nationally known broadcaster, she's no longer with us, named Dorothy Fulltime, and he took shots at her all the time. Now, in real life, they knew each other. Dorothy wasn't bothered by it one bit. She knew exactly what Ernie was doing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he would... he would make fun of her, and she was just a nationally known figure, and you didn't do that back then.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she was not only a figure. She actually interviewed Hitler. She was also part owner in Channel 5.
Yeah. Yeah, and a big, important figure. She was amazing because she was one of the first female broadcasters to reach that incredible stature that she had.
Right.
Back in the day when, you know, women just didn't do that kind of work for whatever reason, but times have changed, and she helped that change come along.
And there was another favorite target of his as well, Dale, Mike Douglas, who started out here in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
And went, you know, but that was a big target of his as well.
Yeah.
He didn't like Mike Douglas?
He liked these people. It was part of his show. That's just what he did.
Shtick.
He made fun of them.
Yeah. Gotcha. Okay.
It was an extreme form of spoofing.
My exposure to Gullardi is only through whatever video content has surfaced and is now on the internet, and I enjoyed it. I sat down and I would watch as much as it was available. It wasn't that I grew tired of it. It was like it ran out. There's no more content. And I enjoyed the heck out of watching Gullardi, quote-unquote, work. I was just amazing. My particular first horror host didn't come around until a decade after Gullardi. So he's kind of a decade, almost a generation before I was around.
Yeah. He, that footage that you've seen, we have one person to thank. As we've discussed on the show, back a lot of the early horror hosts, very little of their work is left because things
right.
were taped over. Things just weren't saved. They were thrown out or taped over. Well, a young fella who was kind of Goulardi's protege, he was his gopher, help with the fan mail. A young fellow named Ron Sweet, who later became the Ghoul.
The Ghoul, right.
Which was sort of a pastiche of Goulardi. The major difference between the two is the Ghoul was something of a spaz, where you could tell, Gar, from what you've seen, Goulardi was a wise guy, much like the Ghoul later became, but he was laid back, cool. He was a beatnik. He was a guru.
Yes.
In a way.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, the Ghoul used a lot of the same catchphrases. A lot of people didn't assimilate to him because they felt that he was just trying to rip off Goulardi, which isn't a fact because he got permission from Goulardi. He said, hey, I want to do a show just like yours. He goes, well, you better change the name or else Store Broadcasting is going to have a problem with you because they own the name Goulardi.
Right.
And so he said, why don't you just call yourself the Ghoul? And another Cleveland television legend was born. But we have him to thank for that footage. So it really was a good time. Wish you could. You'll have to make it one of these years if you can. And we would love to have you here in Northeast Ohio, Gar. We would
well,
love
I've rented
to
a canoe for next year, so I'll be paddling upstream.
Okay. Okay, come up the Ohio River and
there you go.
And into the Cuyahoga, and you'll make your way here.
Always
maybe Dave and I'll split
canoe.
And send you the paddles for the canoe.
Yeah, there you go. yes. Yeah, I do get confused in my memory between the original Svengoolie, Jerry Bishop, and Ernie Anderson. I don't know why I get those two confused. One was in Chicago, one was in Ohio, something like that.
Well, they did use a lot of the, and I think Jerry G. Bishop came a little later, and it's hard to tell because things weren't as accessible as they are today with the internet and all. But
right.
The original Svengoolie did use a lot of the same sound bites,
yeah,
and
right.
even some of the music that Goulardi used.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether, you know, that was borrowed or given in good faith or... Maybe it was just simultaneous good idea because there was a certain vibe and a feeling of that era as well. It's hard to say.
Right.
You know, that's kind of like what happened with, you know, Ernie Kovacs and Steve Allen. When Steve Allen was on Tonight Show and Ernie Kovacs was doing another night show, they'd all be yelling at each other that they invented this bet first, and it was kind of a simultaneous thing. So you never really know who originated it sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
and the two were so different, it kind of doesn't matter.
You had Ernie Anderson, and he was a beatnik. And then you've got the 1970s version of a beatnik, the next generation of oddity, which is your hippie. And that
hippie.
Was Jerry G. Bishop.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, so you've got those two. And that's kind of neat. The horror host we had was neither. He was cool at being uncool because he just wasn't cool. But, yeah. Anyway.
I mean, that's the beauty of having these different horror hosts from the different areas. They all, you know, have their own spin on how they do their shows and a different persona and a different approach to it, which
right.
makes it all fun. And, gosh, maybe if it wasn't for those guys, who knows if we'd be doing what we're doing right now, you know?
And I would actually have to rely on someone, say, like Dave, who's actually watched me do whatever it is I do, as far as, like, what type of personality is coming through. I don't know. I'm just sitting here doing what I need to do.
I know exactly what kind of personality.
Oh,
yours.
Wow. Yeah.
And that's a good thing, Gar. It is a good thing.
Type 7 in the book of abnormalities. Yeah.
And that's what makes you you. And that's why people love you and watch your show. And hopefully come here to listen to you as well as we share these old-time radio shows and talk about all kinds of horror things. Gosh, we're doing coffins this weekend. There's There's been a few movies that are centered around coffins. The Oblong Box, kind of a fun movie with Vincent Price.
I almost showed that film, and there's nudity in it, so I couldn't. Almost.
Yeah. Oh, I'll have to watch it.
Here. Sidebar.
Hi, Fogsbane. Sidebar.
Hello, Fogsbane. Yeah, the Oblong Box, and there were a lot more. I ran across that. I was like, ooh, yeah, that sounds great. And then I was like, ah, nudity. Now, you can edit or put a box over it or whatever, but
mm-hmm.
I don't like to edit other stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that's there.
I was so anal at one time when I was on Amherst City Cable. I superimposed a picture of my smiling face over the naked butt scene in Night of the Living Dead. Because I want kids
be
to
worse.
Be able to enjoy what I do. Same
yes.
like Dave. Exactly. Same like you. We want to appeal to as many people as possible.
Right.
And, you know, for those that do remember horror hosts on television that watch shows like yours, Gar, you know, I'm sure you feel the same way, that we'd like anybody, somebody our age, to sit down with their grandkids and go, this is what old school TV was like.
Right. And it's still generic enough that it doesn't offend, but you still have fun watching it. And the horror host makes it safe to see this scary stuff. Even though someone told me today, maybe it was a few weeks ago, that I had showed something like, yeah, I fell asleep halfway through. It was a snore fest. And I was like, well, it used to be, back in the day, some of these things were kind of riveting if you were young and go, ooh, like you said, the tree monster from Tagawa or Timbawa or whatever that was.
Timbanga.
Timbanga, yeah, okay, there we go, sorry.
Well, I think the thing that shocks people today is different than what it was, and that's
yeah.
why things are so different. Things that shocked us when we were all three youths
uh-huh.
is not the same thing that would probably shock some kids today. They go, really, that's so lame.
We just had that conversation here over at Castle K. I was noticing the original Halloween was on, and we were talking about how people are desensitized, and that's where it comes from, Dave, is the desensitization, because the later generations were exposed to so many of these slasher movies. But a couple things came to my mind as the original Halloween came on. Number one, if you watch it, I don't think you ever see a knife meeting the skin. There's very little blood. It was done, I think,
silhouette.
Tastefully, but with a lot, yeah. Well, an implied in shadow.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, the actual the murders and the cutting with the knives and stuff like that. It was more built on suspense and terror rather
mm-hmm.
than showing. And I think as people ran out of ideas, they decided to add the shock value of showing guts and spleens flying all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about that movie that I think you guys will appreciate, this really struck me like a hammer right in the forehead, which I'm sure you'd like to do. But during the movie, the two kids that Jamie Lee Curtis is babysitting
mm-hmm.
were watching Forbidden Planet.
Oh.
That movie came out in 1978. Forbidden Planet was only a 22-year-old movie back then.
Uh-huh.
Halloween is now a 40-year-old movie.
Uh-huh.
Wow. What? Where did the time go?
Well, if you take a series like what's out now, and it's mainstream, and you had aired it back when you guys were watching your horror host, or when I was watching my horror host, Had the horror host content been The Walking Dead, we would all still be in therapy somewhere.
Yes,
I
couldn't argue that point. You make a very good point there. Any of those slasher films would have been rated triple X back then.
Yes.
And now some of them don't even have an R rating, and they're pretty damn gory.
Mm-hmm. Well. Like you were saying about Halloween, and a throwback a little bit before that would have been Psycho, where it was implied. You saw the shadow. You saw, you know, the after effect, but you didn't see that skin, I think. I could be wrong.
No, you're absolutely
right.
The only thing you see is the blood going down the drain when...
Right, you know.
When
you saw the knife going towards the shower curtain, You saw the shower curtain being ripped off the rod and the blood going down the drain. That's what
and
you
for
saw.
For any kiddies that are listening, what you're actually seeing is chocolate syrup going down a drain.
Yeah. And don't try this at home.
Yeah.
And don't try
especially
this
if you
home.
Have chocolate syrup. Save that stuff for ice cream and whatnot.
Oh, ice cream.
I know, I know. I miss
but
it, too.
Ice cream is something I can't have. But what I can have is some wonderful radio. Tell us a little bit about tonight's CBS Radio Mystery Theater episode, Coffin for the Devil.
Well, it's way back in 1975. It started, you know, Mystery Theater started in 74, only in the second year of in this program. Actually, January 27th, 1975. A lot of regulars were in there. William Redfield, Marion Seldes, are two of the most regular actors on there that showed up on the show. And I'm just kind of thinking here, written by Murray Burnett. And as far as Murray Burnett, he wrote actually a total of 49 episodes of the Mystery Theater. Just think how many radio programs didn't even last 49 episodes. So there you go.
Yeah, the CBS Radio Mystery Theater, when they were done, they had 1,399 original episodes, enough to listen to one episode for almost 4 years.
Every
yes,
day.
And those are different episodes because they did repeat almost every episode. A few episodes they actually repeated more than once, especially the their version of A Christmas Carol, which actually started its host, E.G. Marshall.
Right. But I think it was like the last season or the last two seasons it was on, they were running, re-airing all previous episodes. And then they'd have only one new one per week. But, yeah.
Right. But they did kind of rework the intro so that Tammy Grimes would be the ones doing the all
right,
the hosts.
Right, for the last season. Yep. 1982
right.
It was.
Right.
And it was E.G. Marshall from 74 until moving up until like February of 82 or something like that.
Yep.
Did you pull any of the numbers on that, Dave? That the actors were paid in today's money would be like $378 per show. But the writers got $1,790 in today's money for their participation.
In today's money. In today's money. Yes.
No. Back in 74, they were the writers got $350 and the actors got $73.92. Who came up with 92 cents? I don't know.
That was scale union rate for a performance.
There you go.
And remember, most of these, except for maybe Robert Dryden, you think they weren't earning a living off of this. They were, you know, this was done in New York. Israel, a lot of these people were stage actors and Broadway actors and off-Broadway actors and things like that. So, you know, unless they really didn't need the money that they would do it, you know, and certainly collect the paycheck for what you did. But for most of them, they, you know, if John Lithgow did two stories, he was performing on Broadway. He did two Mystery Theaters. Morgan Fairchild did at least one episode. There are some big names that did this simply because, hey, they had a little extra time, that sounds like a cool thing. I like what Radio Mystery Theater does. And let's go in and be part of it.
Yep.
I was just amazed at how long it ran.
Yep.
It is, in all those episodes, you know, no matter
Eight
how
years?
You stack it up, that's an amazing feat on top of all the other radio programs that Hyman Brown produced and directed over the years during the golden age of radio.
Mm-hmm.
And with that being said, let's go ahead and start part one of CBS Radio Mystery Theater, A Coffin for the Devil, from January, I think you said 27th?
27th.
1975. We'll be back after part one.
And now, Mystery Theater.
Thank you.
Come in. Welcome. I'm E.G. Marshall. And, as you may suspect, I have a tale to tell. A tale full of sound and terror and signifying... Well, I'll have to leave that to you. And I also ask your indulgence when I personalize this strange riddle, because this story was brought directly to me. Ever since I've been your host on this series, I have the feeling that you expect me to be an expert on the macabre. But I must confess to a sense of surprise when I was buttonholed by a young man the other day who said, "Excuse me, Mr. Marshall, but I have a coffin that I'm sure will interest you."
You cannot frighten me. I am not leaving this graveyard until I get to the bottom of this.
I warn you, your persistence will be your destruction.
I still trust in the Lord. Where's that music coming from?
From beyond the grave.
Is it Judgment Day?
No.
Then you talk nonsense. The dead will rise. The Lord will summon his elect to meet him in the clouds. But until that day, the dead remain buried.
Our mystery drama, A Coffin for the Devil, was especially adapted for the Mystery Theater by Murray Burnett and stars Keir DeLay. What do you do when a perfect stranger tells you he has a coffin which might interest you? My first instinct was to tell a young man that I wasn't in the market for coffins. But he quickly explained that he wasn't a salesman, but an avid listener to our series, and that he had a macabre story of a strange coffin that had been in his family for generations. I was intrigued. So the next night, I found myself in his old suburban house, drinking coffee with his wife, Cora, and his friend, Professor Gerald Barker, and looking at a large wooden box, which appeared to me to be a case for a bass fiddle.
This box, although you may not believe it, Mr. Marshall, is a coffin. And this letter, which my wife, Cora, found in the attic, explains how it came in our family and also how it happens that I'm not today a mortician. It was written by my great-grandfather, whose name was also William Spindles. And the letter begins, "I, William Spindles, swear this to be a true and honest account of the strange happenings that befell me when I was employed by Edward Rogers, the undertaker, in the year 1851. The month was December, and Mr. Rogers and his good wife, paying pre-Christmas visits, had left me in charge of the shop. It was a cold night and blowing hard, but my good friend Richard Clay and I were snug enough with a big fire going in the stove.
Only for you, William Spindles, would I spend a stormy night like this sitting in an undertaker's parlor.
Ah, come on now, Dick. You kept me company often enough to know that there's no harm in corpses.
Well, it's not the corpses that worry me. It's their spirits that may be around.
There's no such thing as spirits. Mr. Rogers says that there's no harm in the dead. The harm is in people's minds.
Oh, maybe. Maybe. What's that?
Someone's at the door. Come in.
Oh, I don't like this.
I'll see who it is. Come in, sir. Come in. You'll catch your death of cold standing out there.
I'm sorry to disturb you on a night like this, but my need is urgent. I require a coffin.
Yes, sir. Did you have a particular type in mind?
Very particular. I know exactly what I need.
Well, we have a complete stock in the next room. Now, if you'll follow me...
No need. You won't have it in stock.
We carry the most complete line in the state.
That's why I have come here.
Well, thank you. Now, if you'll tell me who the coffin is for, I'll be able to help you better.
For me.
For you? You mean it's for your own personal use?
Exactly.
I can see you're going to be busy, Bill, so I'll run along.
Oh, no need to leave, Dick. This gentleman will have to come back tomorrow and see Mr. Rogers, so I
cannot return.
Mr. Rogers is the proprietor, and I honestly believe you'll be better served if you wait for him.
I can draw you the way the coffin must be. Here's $50. Will that cover it?
But I...
Goodbye, Bill. I really must leave. Amy's expecting me.
Is the $50 enough?
It's not the money I was thinking of. It's the special requirements you mentioned. I'm not sure I can handle them.
I said I'd draw it. Do you have paper?
I guess so. I... Here's a pencil.
I have my own. Now, the shape must be exactly like this. Just so.
But that doesn't look like a coffin at all. It's more like the case for a musical instrument.
I know my needs.
Never in my life have I seen or heard of a coffin such as you ask for.
It must be exactly the way I've drawn it.
Very well.
Now, it must also have lids and hinges.
Hinges?
Right. Hinges. You see them? Here, on the drawing.
Yes, but you...
And a lock on the inside.
The inside?
And a good quality lock. Secure. Nothing shoddy, you understand?
I believe I do.
Good. Now, if you have a tape measure, I want you to measure me around.
But why? I mean, the drawing is... It's unusual. It's very clear.
I want to make sure that you leave enough room for my arms.
I really don't know how I'm going to explain this to Mr. Rogers.
Show him the drawing. Now, take my measurements.
Yes, sir. All right, now leave enough room for your arms.
Now, make sure that this is ready by Friday.
But that's the day after tomorrow.
I must have it. I'm sorry to be so particular, but I've been buried before. And this time, I want to have it my own way.
Bill! Bill! Are you in there?
Just a minute. I'm opening the door.
Lucy! What are you doing here?
Are you all right? Is he still here?
What are you talking about?
Dick told me about that strange man who came here. Dick was really scared. He said the man wanted to order his own coffin.
That's right, but I'm sure it was some kind of practical joke.
Well, I don't care what it was. I want you to find another job. I hate the idea of your being an undertaker.
Lucy, we've been through this before, and this job is no different than any other except in people's minds.
I'm sorry, Bill. I'm sorry. I was just so frightened. All the way over here, I was just worried about you and scared, but I came anyway, and now... Oh, Bill... I don't think it's going to work.
Oh, I'd like to punch Dick Clay right in the nose for frightening you like that.
Oh, don't blame Dick. It's not his fault.
If he hadn't scared you, you wouldn't have...
Yes, I would. Maybe I wouldn't have come here tonight, but I hate what you're doing. I hate it.
I know, honey. What do you want me to do?
Quit.
And do what?
Oh, I don't care.
What will we live on?
Well, you'll find another job.
Nowhere near as much money.
I don't care about the money. Bill, can't you understand? I don't want hands touching me that have been touching death all day.
All right, Lucy. I'll speak to Mr. Rogers about leaving.
Good morning, Bill. Good morning. Now, what's all this about some excitement you had here last night?
Well, good morning, Mr. Rogers. I guess Dick Clay has been busy gossiping again.
Well, I don't know whether it came from Dick or not, but I heard it from the barber. Some ridiculous claptrap about a walking cadaver ordering its own coffin.
Well, sir, what happened was unusual.
How so?
Take a look at this.
Hmm?
This is a drawing made by the gentleman who ordered this coffin.
Remarkable. Looks something like a carrying case for the bass fiddle.
Yes, sir, it looks that way to me also. It must be ready tomorrow evening.
You're worried about something, aren't you, Bill?
Yes, sir.
Something to do with this special order.
I suppose so, in a way. Mr. Rogers, I'm sorry to tell you that I'm going to have to leave here.
What? You mean because of last night?
Only partially. It's really because of Lucy.
Oh, I suppose she's upset about the idea of marrying a mortician. Hmm?
More than upset, she's... Well, she practically gave me a choice, either this job or her.
I wouldn't worry about that if I were you, Bill.
You're not me, and you're not engaged to Lucy.
I'm sorry, Bill. It's just that I've been there before. I had the same problem with Mrs. Rogers before we got married.
Well, what did you do?
Before I answer that, how do you feel about the business? I mean, would you stay on if Lucy would marry you?
I think so.
Bill, you know I have no son. No one to carry on. I've never said it, but I think you know how I feel about you and what hopes I have that you might be the one to carry on. Until today, I thought you felt the same way.
I don't think I can change Lucy's mind.
Of course you can't.
But you just said that...
You can't. But Mrs. Rogers can. Now, ask Lucy to talk with her, woman to woman. That's your best bet. My wife knows all the problems and she has all the answers.
I never thought of that. All the same, I wish you'd been here last night. It was... Well, the only word I can use to describe what happened is weird.
Because he ordered a coffin for himself?
That, plus the way he came in and then the strange shape he insisted on. But most of all, because he appeared to be driven. Almost as if he were compelled to do what he was doing.
What he felt or didn't feel isn't important, Bill. What matters is whether you've changed the way you think about death.
I don't follow you.
You have to see dying for what it is, Bill. Life's ultimate destination. It's nothing to be afraid of. It's just an inescapable fact. In the course of my life, I've met a lot of people, and I'm good at judging them. And up until now, I've thought of you as a no-nonsense, feet-on-the-ground, level-headed young man.
But, sir, you didn't see this man. You didn't hear the terrible desperation he had in his voice.
I've seen and heard almost everything since I started some 18 years ago. This poor fellow who ordered his coffin from you last night was obviously deranged. No question about it. Deranged.
I hope you're right, sir.
Of course I'm right. What other conclusion can there be?
The one I can't get out of my head. He told me he'd been buried once before. And this time he means to have it his own way.
Oh, very good. Very good indeed.
You find that amusing?
Now I understand everything. That coffin he ordered is nothing but a big fiddle case. A double bass box. And he must be a musician. They're the very devil for playing practical jokes. Don't you see? This is nothing but a practical joke.
A joke on whom, sir?
How should I know? Some fellow musician.
No, I'm sorry, sir. I just can't believe that.
Why not?
Why wouldn't he have told me so? Why would he try to scare the daylights out of me and then pay $50? 50 whole dollars besides.
Ah, well. I expect we'll have the answer to that tomorrow evening when he comes to get his coffin. That is, if he comes at all.
Oh, he'll be here. I'm sure of that. I just pray that we won't be sorry when he comes.
When the reading stopped, I looked at the faces in that sane and sensible 20th century living room. Spindle's wife, Cora, was wide-eyed. Professor Barker's lips were pursed and his eyes were skeptical. My eyes were drawn automatically to the subject of the letter. The large, strangely shaped coffin that stood in the corner of the living room, and I could understand the fear that had gripped that 19th century William Spindles. I'll be back shortly with Act Two.
And we'll be here to give you Part Two in just a little bit.
So this is an interesting story. They're pulling us back and forth between, what, the present day and then going back to 1851. Which is the time of the letter, right?
Yes. Yes.
So this guy cruises up, this mysterious customer, and offers $50. And we go, $50? What's so big about that?
So do you have the GAR calculator going?
Hang on. Tick. $1,637.31 due to the inflation. $50 went a little bit further back then.
A little bit.
Yeah, the power that, well, even in our lifetimes, if you look at the power of the dollar or the strength or lack of, it's kind of, you know, the economic indicators can, you know, it's just interesting to check that out. Just during your lifetime, see what's going on with the strength of our currency. And of course, all three of us were alive when we went off the gold standard, I believe, yes?
Yeah.
It was, yes. Nixon, right?
Hillary Nixon, yeah.
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah. So.
Yes.
And that's when it's, our money's not backed up anymore. I think.
Economics 101 with Gar the Ghoul.
Oh, yeah. Well, there was a point in time where, you know, that was a direction I was going to take years ago, but life had other plans for me. So.
I think you're better off hosting horror films.
You're better off being poor and staying where you are. Just don't worry about it.
Absolutely.
Eat your gruel and toast and shut up. Yeah. Yeah.
This way you'll get the respect you deserve.
That's right. It's all about, you know, the strength of your character. It's like, what about the strength of my bank account? You don't need that.
That's right. Who needs to live indoors?
Yeah, exactly. A porta potty can be your friend. You know, hey,
right.
Why not? You know, yeah, sure.
I've gotten used to indoor plumbing. I'm going to stick with it.
I enjoy it as well. So this is a fun tale and CBS Radio Mystery Theater, which was my doorway into old radio. What was this? And then years later on a public radio station, did I hear The Great Gildersleeve, which further was like, oh, I just have to find out more. But CBS Radio Mystery Theater was something that happened in my childhood that just was like, oh, this is fantastic.
Yes, and it was. And what a tremendous presentation, the music. And we got some great music coming up during one of the scenes. Not going to be a spoiler, but some great music coming up during one of the scenes real soon here, which was it didn't seem like just their regular stock music that they used.
Right. Did you check out the one of the reasons why some of the music beds in some of the CBS Radio Mystery Theaters are so great is it's because it's taken from the CBS Twilight Zone library.
Right. When Rod Serling sold all his rights out to the Twilight Zone, which his wife never did forgive him for like $500,000, which was a heck of a lot of money back when that went off the air. And it was almost immediately after the show went off that he just said, okay, I'm done with this. And he sold all of his rights to CBS.
Mm-hmm.
And that included all the music and everything. That just entered the CBS
audio
library. And, you know, you had everything from Gunsmoke to anything that would be allowed on, that was on produced by the CBS group that would be allowed to use that music.
Mm-hmm. Was Star Trek? I thought Star Trek was NBC.
Yes,
it was originally, I think, NBC.
So maybe it was just a classical theme that Star Trek used once, like Rachmaninoff or something, and they put it into a battle sequence between Kirk and a Romulan or something. And I heard it. I on one of these episodes, I heard that, and I was like, "Ooh, they stole that from Star Trek."
Of course, all the classical music obviously is in public domain.
Exactly. Yes.
So,
yes.
Whether if they do it with a studio orchestra, it would belong then at that point to CBS.
Right. Yeah. The Star Trek music beds are just so much of a favorite. Maybe not everybody's into Star Trek, but the original series back in '68 or '66 or whenever.
For me, it's Lost in Space. I thought it was, and also Johnny Quest. I thought they had the most exciting adventure music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I am there. Yes.
And I love the in the credits for Lost in Space. You had the composer, Johnny Williams, the same John Williams who would later compose Star Wars and Superman and all those great soundtracks.
Right.
But he was Johnny.
Yeah. He was Johnny. It was a young man.
And he was a young man. He was Johnny. And he grew up, and he was just gone.
Yes.
I just recently started watching the old Lost in Space original series, and an episode called, I believe it was called The Robotoid or something like that. This was awesome, okay? You had the robot from Forbidden Planet.
Right.
You had that great music from John Williams, but they mixed in that wonderful Bernard Herrmann music from The Day the Earth Stood Still. And it's like, this is sci-fi heaven for me. Too bad it was already the point where the show started turning corny, but I digress. We do have more CBS Radio Mystery Theater, and this is such an exciting episode. I think we should go ahead and move on to part two, and that way we can hear the exciting music Dave referenced. And here we go. We'll be back after part two.
Like many time-worn sayings, the old adage, curiosity killed the cat, but satisfaction brought it back, still contains more than a few grains of truth. Certainly all of us sitting in the William Spindle's living room that night were anxiously waiting for him to resume reading the letter from his great-great-grandfather. But he further whetted our curiosity by prefacing his reading with this explanation.
I think it's important to tell you that this next portion of the letter is an eyewitness account, not what was told to my ancestor, but what he experienced himself. So, if you're all ready, I'll continue. After Mr. Rogers told me what had happened to him that night in the cemetery, I was still undecided about leaving the undertaking business, although my dear Lucy was at me every day to give my notice. And then, one morning, Mr. Rogers called me to his office.
Sit down, Bill. I think we should have a talk.
Yes, Mr. Rogers.
My wife tells me that Lucy hasn't been to see her. Have you spoken again to Lucy about discussing your future here with Emily?
No, sir.
You still believe that our strange customer was a ghost?
Let's say I'm still undecided. What's that?
Probably someone who wants to see me. Come in.
Should I get the door?
Don't bother. I'll go.
Good morning, gentlemen.
It's you.
It is indeed I. And I'm not sure how long I'll be permitted to stay.
Long enough, I hope, to give me an explanation of your actions the other night.
That is why I'm here.
Good. Perhaps you'll start by telling me...
I come here, sir, at great personal risk. I ask you to believe me. I beg you to listen and keep an open mind.
I believe I'm a fair man.
Since you're a native of this town, you must know of the Addison family.
Of course. Old Thaddeus Addison owned the leather and dye plant.
He did. And do you remember a young man named Tom Addison, one of Thaddeus's three sons?
I never knew the young rascal. Everyone heard about him, of course. He was a ne'er-do-well who finally ran away.
That's what my father wanted everyone to believe.
Hold on. Are you trying to tell me you're Tom Addison?
My father wanted me to go into the factory. I couldn't abide the thought. In all modesty, I had a great talent for music, particularly the bass, a talent which my father felt was foolishness. All of our quarrels came because I wanted to practice my music, and my father thought it was a waste of time and money.
Then you are young Addison.
I am. And I am not. Not in the sense that you mean.
I suppose you can explain that.
The situation between my father and me became unbearable. He finally gave me an ultimatum. Either I go into the business, abandon my music, or he'd turn me out of the house. I really had no choice. I left.
Mm-hmm. And what brought you back?
The very same thing that took me away. Music. When my father disowned me, I wandered around the country trying to earn my living as a musician. It wasn't easy. One day, I found someone who valued my musicianship. I made a bargain with him.
Who was he?
He goes by many names. Take your choice. Satan, the devil, Beelzebub, or the Prince of Darkness.
Rubbish.
You believe in the Lord. Why do you find it so difficult to believe in the devil?
I'm a God-fearing man. The devil has no power over me.
Not unless you invade his realm, as you did the other night.
All I did the other night was my duty, as an undertaker and as a man.
How can I make you see the horrors that lie ahead of you if you will not listen? What will change your foolish obstinacy so that you can save yourself? Are you so insensible that if I tell you what I have suffered and am suffering, you'll still close your mind to what I say?
I promise to listen, and I will.
10 years ago, I was in Chicago, living in a cold and miserable garret, hungry, alone, and with no hope of employment. In order to get something to eat, I knew I'd have to pawn my fiddle. Just before venturing out, I wanted to play it one last time, when suddenly, I thought I'd lost my mind, because
Not only was I hearing my own instrument, but it was joined by a full symphony. And he was there.
Satan?
And he offered me the fulfillment of a dream. I would never have to worry about money again, and I could concentrate on my music. It dazzled me. The prospect of a life I'd always hoped for.
And what did he ask in return? Your soul?
Nothing so dramatic. What seemed a simple, harmless request. All he asked is that I play for him whenever and wherever he should ask. I hesitated, but only for a moment. How I wish I had thought longer on it, but I didn't. I agreed. And now I'm his forever. A member of his orchestra of the damned.
And the letter closes as follows. That was the day I left the undertaking establishment of Edward Rogers. I have no way of knowing whether Mr. Rogers believed the story told by the man who claimed to be Tom Addison. I never saw nor heard from the stranger again, nor do I know whether Mr. Rogers did. Signed, William Spindles. Now, what do you make of that? I'll take the ladies first. Cora, as my wife, what do you think?
There's one thing I know, darling. I'm glad you're not an undertaker, because if you were, I wouldn't be your wife.
Ah, you feel the same way as my ancestors, girl. Lucy.
Emphatically.
Jerry, you're the scientist here.
Well, history isn't a science, thank heaven, but I do have some questions. First, how did the coffin come into your possession?
Well, that's simple. When Mr. Rogers died at the ripe old age of 89, he left a sizable bequest in his will to my great-grandfather with the proviso that we keep the coffin as a memento.
Why would he do that?
Now, that, Cora, is an excellent question. If he insisted that the coffin remain in your family as part of his bequest, I think he must have had a reason.
In other words, you don't believe that the stranger was a ghost.
Let's say I'm dead set against the idea of ghosts playing symphonic music in a graveyard at night.
Well, I believe he was the ghost of Tom Addison.
Well, how do you explain Rogers leaving the coffin to the Spindles family?
Simple. Rogers was probably hurt by Bill's refusal to stay in the business, and he wanted the coffin to remind him.
Sorry, darling, that won't work. If he was hurt, why also leave my ancestor a bundle? And believe me, it was a considerable sum.
Well, then why did he, Bill?
I'm stumped. It's too much for me.
I still don't believe in ghosts, and I think I can prove to you that this man who ordered the coffin was flesh and blood.
How?
Well, I'm going to have to do a little research. When did you say all these things happened? The date, I mean.
December 1851. Why?
Well, give me 2 days, and I'll let you know. Right? I have solved the mystery of our peculiarly shaped coffin.
Good. How?
I kept asking myself, why did this man go to all the trouble of ordering a coffin, which, to say the least, was strange, and also behave as if he wanted everyone to believe he was a ghost?
But have you forgotten Mr. Rogers' belief that he was crazy? I mean, wouldn't that account for all his behavior?
Yes, that would, but I preferred to think of this fellow as a con man. You see, a really great con man who successfully conned your grandfather but had more difficulty with the undertaker.
Why?
Precisely, why? Now, that's where this newspaper article comes in. Here, I made a copy at the library. Let me read it to you. The headline, Wells Fargo Payroll Stolen. Aha, then it goes on. Yesterday, the largest robbery in the history of the Wells Fargo Company was successfully perpetrated by 3 masked men who boarded the westbound Lackawanna Limited, entered the baggage car, and made off with more than $40,000 in $10, $20, and $50 bills. So, it goes into more detail, but there you have it.
There you have it. You've lost me.
Now, don't you see? The robbers needed a safe place to hide the money.
And you think that they decided to use a coffin as a hiding place?
Remember, our man insisted on a strong lock on the inside.
That's true, but
that would be one way of making sure that no one opened this peculiar coffin by mistake and found a wad of tens, twenties, and fifties that had been stolen from Wells Fargo.
But according to the letter, Mr. Rogers found the coffin in the cemetery, and it was open, and there was nothing in there.
That's right, that's right. Rogers followed the stranger right from the funeral parlor to the cemetery. He wouldn't have had time to stash the loot in there.
I think it's interesting, but rather far-fetched.
Is it? Look how everything fits. All that uproar in the cemetery. All the warnings to Rogers telling him to keep away. Why?
I'm sorry. You're so convinced your theory is right, you're not thinking straight. Once your man knows Rogers was going to interfere, he'd never have taken the chance of hiding anything there.
Well, he may have had no choice.
What do you mean?
The money may have already been there. Look, have you forgotten that your grandfather's letter said that the workmen believed the coffin had been tampered with?
Oh, Jerry, you're riding a hobby horse.
Oh.
You have a theory, and you're just going to see that everything fits. And you're not going to look at anything that doesn't.
Now, wait a minute. What have I left out?
Well, lots of things. Now, one, how in the world did our stranger lift this coffin and carry it off under his arm?
Perhaps he didn't.
You mean you think Bill's grandfather made that part up?
Well, let's leave that. Anything else?
Well, lots. What about everything that happened to Mr. Rogers in the cemetery? The music, the open coffin. What's your explanation for that?
Well, we know that Rogers fell down and hit his head.
Oh, come off it, Jerry. You're not going to try and tell us that he imagined those things as a result of hitting his head.
Well, it's possible.
Maybe,
I don't
but...
believe it. The other explanation, which you refuse even to think about, Jerry, is that he was a ghost and that Mr. Rogers reported everything faithfully. That's the one I believe.
Even if I prove to you that this strange-looking coffin has plenty of room for some kind of secret compartment and there may be money in it?
Why don't we stop talking and see if you can prove what you think?
All right, good idea. Come on.
How do we go about finding a secret compartment?
Well, we'll try tapping and listen for a hollow sound.
Okay. Who wants to do the tapping?
Me, let me.
All right, go right ahead.
Ah, it all sounds the same.
You're too impatient. There's a secret compartment. He'd make it hard to find.
All right. Ah, dear. It's a great theory, dear. I'm afraid it's just a theory.
Why don't you try down at the bottom, where it's widest?
Okay.
There! Right there. Does that sound different?
I think so. Go back there again, Cora.
That's it. Let's turn it upside down. Here. You have to... Let us do that, Cora. I've got it now. Now what?
Well, I think we should have opened the lid first.
Okay, let's open it.
All right, now, put your hand down in there, Bill. Feel around carefully. Around the joint in the wood. Yes. Do you feel anything?
Nothing. I can't.
You got it! Jerry was right. It's a compartment. Well, is there anything in there?
This.
Money. A $20 bill. Well, there must be more.
No, that... Just the one bill. But wait. Here's a note.
Well, what does it say?
Wait a second. It's hard to read. Dear Bill, or descendants of William Spindles, you having found this secret hiding place should know by now that I was right when I insisted that there were no such things as ghosts. I was also right when I told you, Bill, that there was a fortune to be made in the undertaking business, as is proven by my bequest. God bless you and your family. Signed, Edward Rogers.
What do you do when you discover that the fortune you expected turns out to be a single $20 bill? Well, if you're William Spindles, you advance the idea that Edward Rogers had indeed found the Wells Fargo loot in the coffin and taken all of it except the one bill. Is there another explanation? I think so, and I'll be back with it in just a moment. For what it is worth, I present you with this thought. There never was any Wells Fargo money in the coffin to begin with. Edward Rogers had obviously been a man of strong beliefs, and he took this way of proving to Bill Spindles or his children that there are no such things as ghosts, and that there was money to be made in the undertaking business. Did the Spindles accept my explanation? I really don't know. How about you? Our cast included Keir DeLay, Marion Seldes, William Redfield, Peter Collins, and Nat Polan. The entire production was under the direction of Hyman Brown.
And it seems we inadvertently skipped part two and steamrolled right to the exciting conclusion. Sorry about that, listeners.
Inadvertent. It was obviously I screwed up when I split it up. Obviously.
Well, that's okay. But I did want to share.
But you know what, Dale?
With our audience.
Hey, Dale. Part two, Dave. Part two and part three are the exact same length.
Ah, I should have noticed. For the edification of our listeners that are not live. Or the live ones that are not following along in the chat, the actor they named Keir Dulay was Dave in 2001, A Space Odyssey. Astronaut Dave.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was my memory and that you played it and I couldn't remember.
No,
it was, as I look at them now, they're both, both part two and part three are the exact same length.
Dave, after the weekend you had, don't worry about it.
Great middle part. What I'm going to do right now for Fogsbane and anybody else that might be directly in the chat. Hang on. Okay, fine. Be that way.
So for the edification of listeners, what happened is they assembled this group and they ascended into the Himalayas and they met Bigfoot, but I think he was a Yeti, and he had a tail, and they had tea, and then they all went home.
To Georgia to write a country song.
Yes, to Georgia to write a country song that wouldn't be released until 1979.
That's right. By the Charlie Daniels Band. There we go. Everything
there
comes full circle, doesn't it?
It does. It does. So that was. Oh, boy. So which direction are we going to now?
Well, I'm just saying what I did, I just posted the episode where Fogg's made go and look and catch that. Elusive Part 2, you can also go to, if you're listening to the archives, you can go to cbsrmt.com and just type in Coffin for the Devil. And it should appear right there for you. But right now, Fogsbane, I think, is hopefully all you have to do is right-click on that, Fogs. It should open it up for you in a new tab and have that right after we since I so wonderfully screwed up the broadcast tonight.
No, that's okay.
It's not screwed up.
We can get our way through anything. And Guy brought up a good point in the chat because it was crossing my mind when they said it. Oh, it's just a $20 bill. But if it's from 1851, it could be worth quite a bit of money
to
a collector. A numismatist, as it were.
Right.
You know, and a little bit about Murray Burnett, in the one who wrote this show, also did some other writing as well. He co-wrote the play Everybody Comes to Rick's with Joan Allison, the former English teacher and Cornell University graduate, was unable to find anyone willing to produce it on Broadway. Consequently, Burnett and Allison sold the play to Warner Brothers for $20,000, where it was renamed Casablanca. That was for television, and in television, let me get back in here, it ran from 1955 to 56 for 9 episodes based on the play Everyone Comes to Rick's. Then something happened because they sold it. Back to this other one. In 1983, Warner Brothers produced a TV series based on the characters from Casablanca. Burnett and Allison promptly sued the studio, claiming they still owned the rights to the characters, even though they had sold the original play. However, a 1986 New York Court of Appeals ruled against them. In later years, Burnett became increasingly frustrated with what he perceived was to be a lack of recognition for his contribution to the classic film.
I'll be darned. Well, folks, to make it up to you, We do have some time left, and we love sharing old-time radio with you in various forms.
Could there be something learned from what we didn't hear?
And that would be the first place that we're going to make it up to you with a little humorous anecdote via... And now, Erie House Radio proudly presents Gar's Moral of the Story. Two-thirds of it.
The only difference between a coffin and a coffer is one of them has a dead guy in it.
Very true. See, now this, now you know that this is a live show. I mean, we, some of our friends and associates do radio shows, and I don't know very many who do them live as we are. Not that I'm saying anything other than that, but with live, you get slight imperfections that you can edit out in a recorded show. We're going to give you all our mistakes and all our idiosyncrasies and everything else, just as they are.
My imperfection of a moral. I rehearsed that for 2 hours, 2 years ago. No,
that was the only perfect part of the show. But
my boinger broke.
At least you didn't give yourself a lot of dialogue to rehearse, so that's good.
Well, yeah, no, I'd get lost.
But
so the second way we're going to make this up to you, folks, I'm going to treat. I'm going to use my virtual nickel and pop it right now into the commercial jukebox.
Is the sweetheart you married the husband you expected him to be? Has the war created new problems for you in your marriage? To answer these and other personal problems brought in by your friends and neighbors, Arid presents John J. Anthony, founder of the famed Marital Relations Institute, in a brand new program of daily sessions of kindly and helpful advice. Just as Mr. Anthony, by examples in this studio, is helping thousands of men and women solve their personal problems, Arid, too, is helping thousands to solve the important personal problem of underarm perspiration. Arid helps you avoid perspiration damage to clothes and safeguards friendships. Use Arid every day. It helps stop perspiration safely, and at the same time, Arid is a most effective deodorant.
And that's for the purposes of us sweating it out here on Erie House Radio.
I have an addition to that. Arid's advice is, if you stink, so does your wife.
What you talking about, Will?
Exactly.
Oh, my.
And with scads and scads of time left, which is a rarity sometimes here on Erie House, we invite you to give us a call if you'd like to talk with us, curse at us. Well, don't curse at us because we'll bleep you and dump you. But you can call.
Curse at Dave.
That's
no.
Right.
Don't curse at me.
Let's, personal email.
Let us not point fingers of any of them, especially the longest one. Rather, let's invite our guests to call in at 646-378-0264 if you'd like to just talk with us or take a chance and spin the wheel of radio. Because we have lots of radio here, you know.
Lots of radio. A lot of radio.
Fogsbane has no phone. I don't know how that works, but hopefully your phone comes home to you after its date. You know, they get out there and do stuff.
I would say that's a form of wisdom because I think people spend a little too much time on their phones. That's just a personal opinion of mine.
You know what? I talked to a guy at Guardi Fest today. He said, I can't watch your show. He says, I don't have cable. I said, okay. Do you have internet? He says, you can just do, you know, Roku. No, I don't have internet. Okay, do you have a smartphone? He says, no, I don't have a smartphone. And he just looked up and said, how do you live?
I've met one person that doesn't have internet or smartphone technology, and I'm like, well, I don't have smartphone.
Dave. I have to know, because I think I know who you were speaking to. He's a regular denizen of Goulardi Fest and an amazing person. I'll describe a little bit more in detail. But was he a thin gentleman with a handlebar mustache?
No.
Okay. Because there was another fellow who told, who's been telling me that for years. He refuses to get a computer. He refuses to get a cell phone. He refuses to jump into today's technology. But this gentleman has the most amazing collection I know of in Northeast Ohio of sci-fi and horror memorabilia. He's roughly 70 years old. His name's Don. And he remembers, because he's a bit older than us, Dave, he remembers very clearly Goulardi, the original broadcasts of Twilight Zone, when they were new shows from the late 50s through the early 60s. He experienced that stuff, and he just feels no need to jump into today's technology. None. I'm hoping to go visit him, and if I do, I'm going to try to interview him and document it. I think I'd like to share, you know, if he'll allow it, you know, bits and pieces of his collection, because it's amazing stuff. It really, really is.
Speaking of amazing stuff, and it's not been edited down, but I know that there's some really interesting stuff in here, because my wife told me some of it happened while we were at Goulardi Fest on Friday. Victoria Price was there, the Vincent Price's.
All right, yes.
And we have a recording of the interview that she did and such. So it's going to take a little bit of editing, but we're going to have a Vincent Price night coming up not too far in the future here, and share bits and pieces of that interview and some of the wonderful things and interesting things she had to say about her father.
Yeah.
Curiously,
and I know you'll enjoy it. We certainly did.
Last night on my little broadcast thing, I aired The Mask of the Red Death, 1964, I believe, and it's Vincent Price. Now, I love Vincent Price. I just, oh, wow, great. This one, the content was a lot of Satanism, and it put me off a little bit. It was odd that I had I talked with the viewers before I aired it 2 weeks earlier. And I said, I ran across this film. I really enjoy it. You might want to look at it on your own. I do not know that I can air it. And the viewers actually responded, well, now that you've talked about it so much, you have to show it. And so and so I did.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing about Gar's viewers. When he starts showing a movie, I think half the time they say, where is Vincent Price?
I don't know, but the wheel of radio is right here. If one of you gentlemen would step forward on the DS and spin
that
wheel.
I screwed up, Dale. I screwed up. I'll go spin the wheel. It's my head hung in shame. I'm reaching up to grab the wheel and give it a good tug.
Around and around she goes, and where she stops, nobody knows.
Well, man, from reading the letters that come into mail call each week, we've discovered a few interesting facts. When it comes to choosing Hollywood stars, some of you like a fine actress, some of you like a good singer, and others of you like a beautiful girl. Well, this week we put them all together, and here's what came out. That vivacious Paramount star, Betty Hutton.
Words of ecstasy, tender.
mug and some cheese and some stuff like that there. I want some petting and some spooning and some happy honeymooning and some stuff like that there. I used to think that love was just a lot of rubbish. I'm as a cabbage, I'm as a cabbage. But now my attitude is holy lovey-dovish. And baby, you done it. I want some kissing and some hoping and some missing and some moping and some stuff like that there. Some leaping and some chasing and some weeping and some pacing and some stuff like that there. And when I get a certain feeling, I confess it. There's really only one expression to express it. I want some hugging and some squeezing and some mugging and some teasing and some stuff like that there.
About mail call. It's from Seaman First Class Joe Daplin, somewhere in the ETO, and he says that mail call has saluted many states in the past, but somehow his own state of New Jersey has been overlooked.
Well, how come you got the letter?
How come I got the letter? I'm from New Jersey.
Then you're here tonight to see that New Jersey has given proper recognition on mail call.
That's right, baby. I promised those guys that I'd put this thing over even if I had to wrestle the MC to do it.
Now, Frank, don't do anything foolish. I weigh more than you do.
Who doesn't? And besides, it wouldn't be cricket. Men don't wrestle with girls. What am I saying?
They don't wrestle with girls. Have you ever been up in the balcony of the Paramount?
No, as a matter of fact, I never go to the Paramount. Too much of a chance of running into a Crosby picture.
Now, Frank, don't say anything against Bing. He has a dressing room next to mine. He's been a perfect gentleman. Not once has he ever peeked through the keyhole.
Of course not. At his age, he can't even get down that far.
You know, I had a lot of fun working with him, and here come the waves.
Yeah, I saw that picture. You played the part of twin sisters. Gee, I wish I had been born twins.
Why?
Well, then I wouldn't need a microphone. I could sing and hold myself up at the same time.
I can't imagine you as twins, Frank.
Why not?
Well, because it's impossible, that's all.
No, it isn't. All they have to do is cut me in half.
Oh, please, let's not split hairs.
Look, before I get belted around here anymore. Let's get back to the New Jersey business.
Well, Frank, I'm sure that Mail Call wants to do right by New Jersey, so how about you starting the salute with the song for all the guys and gals from the Garden City?
Well, a little Garden State, it says
the
right
state.
There.
I mean state. State. Thank you very much.
Well, it'll be a pleasure,
that's
Betty.
New Jersey.
Here's an oldie, but they goodie.
I can't give you anything but love. Baby, that's the only thing I've plenty of. Baby, dream a while, scheme a while. You're sure to find happiness. And I guess all those things that you've always pined for. Gee, I'd like to see you looking swell. Baby, diamond bracelets, Woolworth doesn't sell. Baby, till that lucky day, you know darn well. Baby, I can't give you anything but love. Gee, I'd like to see you looking swell. Bracelets for worth doesn't sell, baby. Till that lucky day, you know darn well, baby, that I can't give you anything but love.
I had the great fortune in my disc jockey career to work at the Marriott on the west side of Cleveland, and they had all kinds of wonderful ideas there for different features and shows, and I got to do a big band night. I could listen to music like we just heard all day and not get tired of it. That was a lot of fun.
You know what, I want to add something about that first song that Buddy Hutton came out with. Of course, Bob Hope, I love the way he explained, introduced her once as a vitamin pill on legs, because she was so energetic. She was one of the flying Huttons. A very energetic person and energetic personality. But she sang a song that I had only heard before on Bette Midler, James Wood movie, For the Boys. And I didn't realize that was actual World War II song until I heard her sing stuff like that there right on the Mail Call that we just played.
Well, she graced the cover of Time magazine April 24th, 1950. Betty Hutton.
She's quite the looker. Quite the looker.
Quite the looker.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And I had a lot of fun as they picked on Frank Sinatra's thinness. I know he was spoofed many times in cartoons as being as skinny as the microphone stand.
Yeah, holding up and the microphone stand holding him up, and there he did just even joke himself on that.
Yes, he did. Well, gang, real fast, want to thank everybody for listening today, and I just want to tip my hat once again to both of my partners here who help share a lot of interesting facts about these shows. I'm still in my learning stages, just like I was back in those days learning big band music at the Marriott, and Dave's had quite a weekend. I think forevermore I'll refer to him as the hardest working man in Horrorwood.
You can just call me by my nickname, Screw Up. Thank you very much.
No. Let's not dwell on that. Rather, let's dwell on what is to come. Next weekend, we resume our regular schedule back to Fridays at 7:30 Eastern and Saturday at 6:30 Eastern. We have got a whole lot of radio for you then as we wish away the weekend with the Creaking Door and also Inner Sanctum. That'll be for Friday night with stories about wishes. And we'll continue with that topic on Saturday. We'll still be wishing with The Weird Circle. Oh, good. I haven't heard one of those in a while. And another one we haven't had for quite some time here on Erie House, Theater 5. And that's next weekend.
A lot of radio.
a hoo-hoo-dee lad radio. Gentlemen, thanks so much. Good luck in prison. And to all of you who joined us today, thanks. And we'll see you next time.
There's no one.
Oops.
The castle lights are growing dim.
See,
there's no one left but me and him.
Hey, Dale.
When next we meet in Frankenstone. Don't come alone.
Good night, fellas. I'll see you next week at the latest.
Toodles, blah, blah.
Ah.
Bye.